Thanks, and thanks for having me here. Thanks for coming out so early. This is actually a pretty good turnout for an 8 a.m. It's better than I would get for an 8 a.m. class, that's for sure. So appreciate that. I'm really excited to come here and get a chance to meet everybody. That's why when Shan and Andrew invited me, I said, sure. I mean, that's a great opportunity as I'm moving to the Midwest to come out and get to meet exactly the people I want to meet out here, who are the people who are, you know, busy working on systems research and related topics. So I'm looking forward to getting to meet as many of you guys as I can today. I haven't really done anything here yet. I just rented an apartment yesterday, so that was a big step forward. So I'm gonna be talking about work that we've been doing at Berkeley. And as Andrew said, you know, the goal is to, you know, move forward and figure out what the next things we're gonna be doing are going to be, you know, as I transition here over the summer. So I'm going to talk about the title. It's a little bit of a bait and switch, I'm afraid. The title is about trends in big data, and that's definitely what I'm going to talk about. But I'm going to do it by telling you about what I've been working on and what our group's been working on, because that's, you know, we put our money where our mouths are. We're, you know, this is what we think is important. This is what we're working on. So I'll try to balance between, you know, general trends and sort of things that we've been doing in our research group. So, but, you know, let me just start. You know, big data, of course, is you know, a popular and maybe too popular topic, but it's worth just for a minute to try to do a little bit of definitions. So this is an example of a really bad definition of big data. It basically says that if you have a certain amount of data, that's big, and presumably if you have less than that, it's not big. And you know, you can see why this is a problematic definition. You know, over time, it's going to look really silly that people were worried about dealing with billions or even trillions of records. I mean, what's so hard about that? You know, 10 years from now. And also, you know, it's got this measure, you know, it's got this problem that if you have, you know, a billion minus one records, then does that mean you don't have big data? So there's got to be something going on more than just the volume of data. And I'm not going to walk you through, many of you probably have heard the 3 V's or the 4 V's or the 5 V's or whatever. And those are actually pretty useful. But I kind of like this thing that O'Reilly did when they were talking about what was important about data in general, to give a flavor of what's kind of qualitatively different about big data compared to what people were doing before with data analytics. And so this is a quote from a book they put out about using big data in healthcare. And it basically just says, you know, there's this treatment for breast cancer that for a long time people had known it was about 80% effective. But now we know much more. We know that for 70 to 80% of the people, it's 100% effective. It works for those people. And then for everyone else, it doesn't work at all, okay? And if you think about it, this maybe sounds a little kind of flip or a little off the cuff, but it's actually a really deep idea. And basically what it says, that if you can collect enough of the right data at the right granularity, you can start to see things that you're just simply not able to see if you don't have that much data, or you don't have that much data at that level of detail. And so, you know, if you're doing drug discovery, you know, if you come up with a drug that's, you know, 1% effective, but you don't know who it's gonna work for, that's not particularly valuable. But if, you know, there's a horrible disease that for even a small percentage of the people that have that disease, you can recognize that this treatment will work for those people, then that's a huge thing. And so, you know, the idea about big data then is really just the ability to be able to collect more and more information at finer and finer granularity, bring all that data together, and then start to see things that you just weren't able to see before. Okay, so it's not a very crisp definition, but qualitatively it gets at why I think there's so much excitement out there about working with data and this idea of big data in particular. You know, because of all this excitement about big data, there's been this sort of tremendous explosion of systems that people have been building, mostly in the open source world, for working with data. And so this is something I found on the web that's, you know, present was 2013, but there's been no end of this, right? There's more and more systems coming out over and over again. And it's funny, last week I was up at Wisconsin for Dave DeWitt's, well, it wasn't officially his retirement party, but after 40 years at Wisconsin, DeWitt's gonna be, you know, moving to the East Coast. And you know, DeWitt and a bunch of other people in the database field, you know, back in the 80s, had pioneered this idea of data parallel processing for doing analytics. And, you know, this technology had been buried in, you know, a small number of database products that were used at sort of large enterprises and governments and things like that, but hadn't really made it out into the general public. You know, Google published a series of very influential papers, in particular the MapReduce paper, and furthermore, people that were aware of this kind of software started building open source tools, things like, in particular, Hadoop, that allowed sort of mere mortals to start working with data parallel programming. And that led to this, you know, explosion of software and development and excitement. So, you know, this is what's been going on, and like I said, the innovation really hasn't stopped at all. And so, what I want to do is talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the AMP lab, you know, as part of this ecosystem and sort of talk about how it fits in. So, you know, you can debate about, you know, what's big data, what's small data, how big does big data have to be, but in some sense that really misses the point. And if you're somebody who's been working in the data management field for, you know, decades, and I know many of you have, and some of you, especially the students, of course, have not, but just so that you know, you sort of understand, you know, don't get hung up on the terms big data, data science, things like that. What you have to realize is that technology, you know, has really fundamentally changed. The way that you think about working with large data sets has really changed completely in the last, you know, decade. You know, scaling, massively scalable, you know, processing and storage has become much more commonplace. You don't have to be at a government lab or at a big company to get your hands on, you know, massively parallel computing. Cloud computing, which allows you to do pay-as-you-go scalability, so you don't have to provision your system for the biggest job you're ever going to have to run. You can incrementally get resources when you need more. You got your credit card, you can get more. When you don't need those resources, you can give them up and you don't have to pay for them. So this has really led to the democratization. These two trends have really led to the democratization of big data analytics. On the software side, the idea of flexible schema, traditionally in databases, so those of you who've taken a database course, you know, what do? You say, okay, I want to create a database. The first thing I do is I design that database. So I think about every piece of information I'm ever going to collect. I think about how all those pieces of information are ever going to relate to each other. I write that down in a schema. I implement that in the database, and then if I survive that long, then I can start actually loading data into the database. That's not how this stuff works. The way this stuff works, you got massively scalable storage. You just take data, you stuff it in, and then you figure out what it looks like later. So sometimes this is called schema on read versus schema on write. And what it's done is it's removed a lot of the friction in creating data-driven systems. Easier integration of a bunch of different modalities for working with data, so you don't just have to do SQL, you don't have to just do, you know, information retrieval, you don't have to just do machine learning, you can bring these things together. I'm gonna talk about that and how we do it in our stack. The fact that you're not tied down to a particular language, but there's all sorts of interaction and programming languages you can use to get it data. And then finally, and I think the most important one, is the fact that most of this innovation is happening in the open source. And so it's happening all over the world. It's happening at universities. For the students in the room, most of the software, actually just about all the software I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes, was written by graduate students, and it's taken over the world. And so, you know, the ability for individuals to build things, get them used by others, and actually go out and impact the world in a very direct way, is fundamentally different. You know, when I was doing my work as a graduate student, you know, you would come up with an idea, you would implement a prototype of it to show that it would work, and then you would go out to companies that were actually building the software and try to convince them that your ideas were worth putting into their products, and maybe they'd do it, maybe they wouldn't do it, maybe they'd do it and not tell you. You just would never know. There was this barrier between you and people who were really going to use the stuff. With open source, that barrier is just gone. So you can directly build stuff, put it out in the world, get a user community, and have real impact, and get real feedback. So, you know, if there's kind of one slide about sort of where things are going, I think this is an important one, because these are the things that have really changed the game, and this is why there's so much new stuff coming out in this field, and why there's so much happening. All right, cool. So I'm going to go through a few trends. I'm going to spend most of my time on this first one, so don't get nervous, because I have a few, but I'm going to do one in some detail, and then I'll go quickly through a few others. But the one I want to talk about first is this idea of an integrated analytics stack, as opposed to you know, siloed or stovepipe systems. So you know, Andrew mentioned this thing that I run at Berkeley called the AMP Lab. AMP stands for Algorithms, Machines, and People. And it's a really interesting project. It's the kind of the most recent iteration or instance of a model of building labs that people at Berkeley had been doing for many, many years. And it's a pretty sizable software effort. It's probably close to about 100 people involved now. We launched it in 2011. We spent a couple years before that getting it started. And we're wrapping it up this year. Part of my transition to Chicago is coordinated with the fact that when we started the AMP Lab 6 years ago, we knew we were gonna end it this year. Another thing that's interesting about AMP Lab for the researchers in the audience is we get about half our funding from the typical places, NSF, DARPA, Department of Energy, and so on. The other half of our funding, fully half, comes from companies. And so we have a membership model. Companies join the lab, they sponsor the work, and then we have a meeting of about the size of this one, actually, twice a year, you know, where people from the companies come in, they meet all the students present their work, and we get sort of very direct and very quick feedback on the work we're doing, and the companies that work with us get to see what the students are working on before the rest of the world sees it. So if you were a member of the AMP Lab, you know, in 2011, you would have seen Spark, you know, in its very, very formative stages and had some influence on where it went. So that's kind of the idea that of this type of labs. You know, Andrew mentioned the Ceres Lab that he's building at Chicago. I think this is a great model for doing very impactful and very exciting work in systems. And so I'm hoping that we can kind of spread this type of model. Intellectually, what AMP set out to do was to integrate sort of three very different resources for making sense of big data. That's where the name comes from. So the idea is you have algorithms for doing, you know, machine learning, statistical analysis, and so on. Machines is you know, cluster computing and cloud computing and so on. And then people is really, there's kind of two aspects there. One is the idea of using the crowd to do data analysis, to do data cleaning, to be part of the processing. And then the other is kind of the more traditional human in the loop type of analytics, where you're trying to realize that you're building systems for people to manipulate data and to try to make decisions based on data. So you have to think about how to support data scientists and analysts who are trying to work with data. So the goal of AMP Lab was to say, okay, can we build a system that lets us seamlessly integrate these three very different types of resources so that for a given data-driven question or a given data-driven problem, I can marshal the right combination of them and bring that to bear to solve the problem. Okay, and that was sort of our mission statement. That was, if you look at the expedition the NSF expedition that we had, that was the scientific objective of that expedition. So here's what we ended up doing. We built this thing called the Berkeley Data Analytics Stack. It's abbreviated BDAS, and we pronounce it badass. And it's got all these different pieces. You kind of have to read this bottom up. Here, let me build this out. You know, resource virtualization. So there's a system called Mesos that allows you to take a large physical cluster and break it into multiple virtual clusters and do all the right resource management for very heterogeneous workloads. There's a storage layer. We leverage HDFS and other scalable file systems very heavily, but we've built some things on top of that for caching and for doing compression, and now there's some work going on in encryption and so on. Above that, processing engines, Spark you've probably heard of, Velox I'll tell you a little bit about. And then really where a lot of the action has been lately has been above that level of building different systems for allowing you to work with the data in different ways. So if you want to run database queries, there's Spark SQL. If you want to do streaming, there's Spark Streaming. If you want to do machine learning, there's MLlib and MLbase and Keystone ML. I'll tell you about some of those. If you want to do graph processing, there's GraphX. And these things all sit on this common substrate. And again, I just want to emphasize, and then driving that has been a bunch of applications that we've been doing with people mostly on campus for doing, you know, genomics, Internet of Things, energy management, and so on, okay? But what's interesting, again, for the students in the room, you know, each of these little boxes here was somebody's PhD thesis, or maybe a couple people's PhD theses. So, you know, the idea again is get a bunch of students to work together, try to arrange things so that people aren't completely independent. Codependent. You want them to be pretty independent. And then allow people, if they want to put the extra work into integrating their research in with this bigger stack, and thereby getting access to many more users. And so, you know, if you have an idea that you want to implement for big data analytics, you know, you can certainly do that and write your papers, but if you do it in a way that works with this stack, you're going to get already interest from, you know, many thousands of people out in the world who are using, you know, bits and pieces of this stack. So good. So this is the Berkeley Data Analytics Stack. I went the wrong way. The other thing is, you know, projects complete, students graduate, and then you move on. So, you know, Mesos, actually the student didn't completely finish his PhD, but Mesos is out in the world. It's pretty heavily used. There's a company called Mesosphere that's been quite successful and is behind that. Alluxio is something that was done, it was called Tachyon when it was done in the lab. And you know, now that's out in the world, and there's a company called Alluxio that's involved in that. Spark, you know, again, done in the lab. Those students did graduate. There's a company called Databricks and many other companies that are doing things with Spark. And so, you know, as these things mature, as projects finish, students graduate, you know, the stuff goes out into the world. Sometimes it catches on, sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, the research can continue. And what we've been focusing on lately is this, you know, kind of right-hand side of the picture. And I'll talk about a few of these pieces, you know, in the next few minutes. Okay, but that's you know how we've organized the stack. And again, this is all open source. Most of it's Apache, or if it's not Apache, it's BSD licensed. So you put it out there; it's freely available. People can take it, they can change it, they can sell it, they can modify it, they can do whatever they want. And that leads to very, very quick adoption for things that turn out to be useful. All right. So all right. Sorry, you probably have heard about Spark, but just to give you sort of a feel of what that's been like. So at the beginning of last year, I took this snapshot of a company called meetup.com that organizes meetups on all sorts of topics. And if you have a topic that people have meetups about, they'll have a webpage where you can go and see where the various groups are. So beginning of last year, there were 43 groups that they had listed that were meeting, you know, fairly regularly to talk about Spark. You know, kind of across 14 countries and 12,000 members. The end of last year, that had grown, you know, from 14,000 members to 52,000 members, you know, kind of across the whole world. And then I looked this morning and they've changed their, they somehow changed the way they do accounting. So all of a sudden this morning, we jumped to 392 groups with, you know, almost 200,000 people. And I think what happened here is they basically started digging a little deeper into sort of what the groups say they do. So initially it was basically there were groups that were called, you know, like the San Francisco Spark Meetup Group or the Chicago Area Spark Meetup Group or whatever, and those got counted. Now I think they looked a little deeper, and if you said something about Apache Spark in your list of interests, they counted you. But anyway, just sort of explosive growth. And, you know, again, if this was your PhD research, you'd be pretty excited to get, you know, to get this kind of uptake and this kind of interest. And this happens because of, you know, the open source community. right? And if you build something useful and then do a little extra, or maybe a lot of extra work to go out and help people use it and promote it a little bit, you can get these kinds of viral effects. So Spark's been incredibly popular. It got kind of ridiculous. This was an article that showed up at the end of last year. O'Reilly did this big data study where they tried to say which skills of data scientists lead to how much money. And the number one skill that came out on the top of their list was Spark. That gave you, if you learned Spark, they gave you the biggest bump in your salary. And the funny thing about this article for the students in the room, not for the professors, is that was actually quite a bit higher than getting a PhD. So the net income change of learning Spark is higher than the net income change of getting a PhD, according to this analysis, with error bars, of course. Yeah, and it may not be a stationary property. There's a lot wrong with that. But I just love, that was kind of the world that we were living in as this stuff was taking off. There's just all this kind of crazy stuff about it. But anyway, I thought this one was kind of fun. All right, so great. So what really is Spark, and why did it catch on like that? So, the idea was, I showed you very early, this kind of explosion in all these, systems for dealing with big data. And the problem is what people were doing is they're saying, hey, this MapReduce thing is cool, right? It lets me use lots of computing power, but it doesn't do exactly what I want to do. I want to do graph processing. So I'm going to build, Pregl or Giraffe or some other system that just does graph processing. Or, it doesn't do streaming. So I'm going to build Storm or something like that, that does, stream processing. And the problem with that is you end up with a bunch of stovepipe systems that, don't work together, that when you're trying to build an application that needs more than one of them, there's this, heavy lifting that you'll have to do to try to figure out how to get these things to work together. They're all open source projects, they're changing constantly, so you've now got this kind of collection of software that you're trying to, keep track of and as one thing changes, see if it doesn't break something else in some other system that's a completely different system. And so we said, okay, well, look, this isn't really a good state of affairs. And if you look at it, the problem was that what people were doing is they were saying, okay, I'm going to take MapReduce and I'm going to specialize it to solve my problem. And what we did in Spark is we said, well, wait a minute, let's not do that. Let's do the opposite. Let's, instead of making MapReduce more narrow, let's generalize it. Let's make it a little bigger, and then maybe we can solve more problems with it, and you won't have this plethora of all these different systems that you're going to have to figure out how to use. So that's what Spark is. It's a generalization of MapReduce. And then you use that as a substrate to build all those different things we talked about, graph processing, stream processing, query processing, and so on. And so there's two things. I think most of you guys know Matei Zaharia is the guy who really was the architect and the builder of Spark, and he did this, as a PhD student. And Matei really had two things that he wanted to do to MapReduce that got into Spark. One is he wanted to make it a richer programming model, so right, not just map and reduce, but a bunch of other things, okay? And this means you don't have to learn all these different systems, you can just learn this system. And then I'll show you in a second, there are some technical things about the way Hadoop was built that made it inefficient for very popular types of data analytics. And in particular, it had to do with the fact that it doesn't share data across different stages and different jobs. And so fix that problem. So allow data sharing across all these rich operators that you've implemented. And that's going to allow you to cut down on data movement, which is going to make things go faster. So if you do these two changes, you can implement all these different modalities, graphs and streams and database, relational queries and so on. And you can do it in an efficient way. You can actually share data across those different modalities. And that's really what Spark did. That was the main idea behind Spark. So here's kind of a nice little animation. So let's say you were, trying to learn a model on some data. So you have, you have your training set. And if you're going to do this in MapReduce, Hadoop MapReduce, then what you do is you read in your training data, you start with your initial model, you do your maps, right? You process the data, you do your reduce, you combine the results, you come up with a model, you write that thing out to disk, okay? But the problem is that a lot of these algorithms that work this way are iterative. So you don't do it once, but you do it multiple times until your model converges, right? So if you're going to do that and to do MapReduce, what happens is let's say, okay, I've got my, I started with an initial model, I've got a new model, but it's not good enough, so I'm going to iterate. So what do? I read my training data in again, I map it, I reduce it, I write out my model, and I iterate again, okay, and you keep doing this. And so, you know, if you look at what this is costing you, you know, every iteration, I forgot that I already loaded my training data set. Okay, so I'm gonna read it all in again, maybe to the same place, maybe to different places. But Hadoop MapReduce didn't have a way of remembering that you had already read things into memory and where you put it. Okay, so you're loading the data over and over again. And then, okay, nice animation. And then, you know, at the end of every stage, you're writing the data back out. Okay. And so, you know, what this looks like from a data, what this looks like from a data flow point of view is every iteration I'm reading my data in, every iteration I'm writing it back out. Okay, and so I'm basically communicating from one iteration to the next through the disk, which is typically not the fastest way to communicate in a modern computing system. And so if you think about it for a little bit, you say, okay, well, you know, how hard could that be? So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna read stuff into memory, and I'm gonna remember that I read it into memory. And then at the end of the iteration, I'm not gonna write things out to disk and read it back in. I'm gonna just keep it in memory, and I'm gonna allow the next stage to read what I wrote, okay? And so this is really, from a data flow management point of view, this is what Spark did that was different than Hadoop MapReduce. It basically was smarter and paid more attention to how data was brought in from disk into memory, and then kept track of what's in memory and allowed, you know, subsequent processing to use what's in memory, okay? And if you do that, it's not gonna be a surprise that things are gonna go, you know, 10 or 100 times faster than if you did it, you know, using the disk the other way, okay? And so that's why, you know, Spark took off so quickly, because, you know, it did everything that MapReduce did, but it did it faster, and it did a bunch more, okay? So the key idea behind Spark then is this idea called resilient distributed data sets, or RDDs. And the problem is, okay, so you know, why was Hadoop MapReduce writing things out to disk so much? Okay, and the reason is it was for fault tolerance. So the design point for Hadoop MapReduce was a pretty interesting one. They said, okay, we want to allow kind of infinite scalability. We want to allow you, as you know, if you're walking down the street and you find a rack of servers that somebody's throwing out, you say, hey, those look like they might be pretty good. You pull them into your data center, you wire them up, and all of a sudden you can use those computers, right? And if you find some more computers, you can add those. And so the idea was, you know, you wanted to have massive scalability, but you wanted to do it in a way that allowed you to have sort of very heterogeneous, not necessarily the latest and the most best cared for machines. And so in that world, with lots and lots of machines that you're not sure are 100% reliable, running large analytics jobs, you're pretty sure that at some point during your processing there's going to be a failure, right? So in the database world, you know, I talked about, you know, parallel databases and the work Dave DeWitt and others did. The idea there was, I have some number of nodes. They're nodes that I built, you know, that I put together, that I manage, that I know are good, and I don't really have that many of them. And so chances are when I start my query, they'll all still be running at the end of the query. But in this world, the world that Hadoop was designing for, that wasn't the assumption. The assumption was, in fact, the opposite, that during the processing, something would die. In the database world, if failures are rare, you say, okay, it doesn't happen that often, so I'll just restart. If something fails, I'll kill the whole job, I'll restart it. But if you're expecting a failure, that's exactly the wrong thing to do, because when you restart it again, something else will fail, and you'll never finish. And so the idea of Hadoop was to be able to say, okay, I want to be able to make continuous progress. So if something fails, I've stored partial results out on disk, I can go find those, and then I can continue. And so if you want to play this trick that Spark played of being smarter about how you use memory, you have to preserve that fault tolerance. So you need a way of coming up with, you want to use memory, but you still want the system to be able to tolerate lots of partial failures. And so that's what RDDs do. And the idea that Matei had, I think it was Matei's idea, he certainly implemented it, was to say, okay, let's make these data sets immutable. Okay, so you create a data set, you distribute it across the cluster, and then you're not allowed to change it. So all you can do is read it, and you can then transform it using one of these rich operators into a new RDD. Okay, so they're distributed, immutable objects. And as long as you keep track of where the pieces are, if if something, if a node fails, you can rebuild whatever you lost on that node. Okay, and I'll show you in a second sort of how we do that. And by extending the language beyond just map and reduce, we were able to build a system that was rich enough to implement all these different types of processing models that we were talking about. All right, so this is the kind of the key technical concept in Spark. You know, I talked about generalizing MapReduce. This is what I meant. So if you look at the operators that you can run on RDDs, one of them is map, one of them is reduce. So you can do everything that map and reduce can do already. And then there's a bunch of other things. So if you're a database person, like myself, this will warm your heart, right? You got sorts, you got unions, you got joins, you got left outer joins, you got, there should be joins in there. You know, you have many more operators that you can do on these RDDs. And the trick is, you know, each one of these takes as input an RDD or two RDDs and outputs a new one. Okay, so you don't change the input ones, you create a new one. All right, so if you're doing that, then you get this nice benefit, which is fault tolerance becomes fairly straightforward in that case. So here's a statement that basically takes a file, runs a filter on it to just pull out the lines that contain the word error in that file, and then pulls out a column from each of those lines. Okay, and that, so what this is doing, I don't know, I'm gonna hit the wrong button, I'm almost positive, yep. Okay, so what that's doing is that's creating a new RDD called messages. And if you look at that, this statement then is a recipe, right? It's a logical log of what you need to do to recreate that RDD. So basically, you read the file from Hadoop, you run this filter on it, you run this map function on it, okay? And so as you're running the program, you're building this lineage that's going to tell you how to recover any piece. So if you lose a piece of you know, of this RDD, you can recover it by, you know, running you know, these on the pieces that you know, that you lost. Okay, so that's kind of the key idea of how RDDs implement fault tolerance. Okay, so then given that, we said, all right, we want to build this richer system, so what can we build with it? So Spark SQL is the thing that we built for doing query processing. And we originally took the Hive system, which was a query processor built for Hadoop MapReduce, and we ported it to Spark, and that was something we called Shark. And then, you know, again, this is the beauty of the open source community. We literally lifted that code and you know, converted a few parts of it, and were able to run, you know, queries with, you know, just a couple students basically doing that work. But ultimately we found that, you know, there was some baggage in the Hive system that we didn't really want to have to live with, and that we thought there were some things we could do better, knowing that we were building it for Spark. So that got replaced recently, or not that recently at this point, with something called Spark SQL. And what it does is it's got tighter integration with Spark than Hive had, and it's got this new data type called data frames, which I'll mention in a second, and it's got a new query optimizer. And you know, again, this is something that's you know, part of the badass stack. It's been used pretty heavily. It turns out something that was surprising to my systems colleagues, but not surprising at all to me and to my database friends, is it turns out that there's a lot of analytics you'd like to do that are easier to do by writing queries than writing programs. And so there's a lot of people in industry that would prefer, even though they want to use Spark, they'd rather write SQL for a lot of what they're doing. So Spark SQL lets them do that. And it's been used at scale, you know, on thousands of nodes, you know, on databases that are many petabytes, although it's not clear the queries are running on all those petabytes. All right, so that's Spark SQL. Once you do that, this is the kind of thing that we can do then. I forgot which button. Oh, I knew it. Sorry. Is that the backwards button? Oh, okay. All right, so here's an example then of what you can do in an integrated stack. Here's a SQL query on some tweets, and I'm going to call that my, I'm going to build a training data set. So this is actually going to be an RDD. Then I can run some machine learning using this MLlib, which is another part of the stack, to train a model on that training set. And then I can apply that model on a stream of incoming data. And this is all done within a single program in the Spark environment. Okay, as opposed to having to use one system for streaming, one system for MySQL queries, and one system for my machine learning. All right, so that's what I mean by an integrated environment. Data frames, I'll just mention briefly. So those of you who work with statistical languages, the fundamental abstraction there is something called a data frame that looks a lot like a relational table. You know, it's a matrix of data. And so what Spark SQL does is it allows you to look at data as a data frame or as a relational table, and it doesn't really care. And so this is, this is basically the equivalent of a query written in the data frame sort of imperative language. And some, if you like this, then you can use it. If you like SQL better, you can use that. All this stuff, whether it's SQL or data frames or whatever, it gets run through this single optimizer called the Catalyst Optimizer. The optimizer builds an internal representation of what you're trying to do and then plays the typical query optimization tricks to make it run faster. What's interesting about Catalyst is if you take basically the same query and you write it in SQL, you write it in R using the data frame interface, you write it in Python or Scala using the data frame interface, you get basically the same performance. And that's because that's exactly what's happening, is the system's taking those, compiling them into the same internal representation, and then running them. So that's kind of a nice approach there, that if you're more comfortable with R, you can write that. If you're more comfortable with SQL, you can write that. In either case, you can get query optimization. So that's one of the nice things that was built into the system. Just quickly, another nice thing that's in the system is you can point it at a file of JSON, and it'll do the schema on read stuff. It'll say, oh, okay, you know, here's a schema that most of that JSON conforms to. In this case, all of it does. So if I had this schema, this would represent all those JSON objects. Okay? And so you can do type inferencing for JSON and for CSVs and some other formats. And then what you can do with that is it's kind of fun. Again, this is an integration story. So you can say, all right, I'm going to create a table using a SQL query. Okay, so I'm going to pull this table out of a MySQL database using this JDBC interface. I'm going to call that users. And then I'm going to have another table I'm going to create called logs, which I'm going to use by doing that schema inference on this JSON file. So I'm going to point it at this JSON file. It's going to figure out what the schema is, and it's going to create a temporary table with that schema. And then once I've done that, I can just run SQL on it. So, this is, on one slide with a few things missing, but not much. You've got a table in a MySQL database. You've got a file, a JSON log file, sitting out on a server somewhere, and you want to run a query on them. And you do it with that, with that much code. And it all gets run through the same optimizer. So it's a pretty powerful system. We also have in it approximation. So again, if you're doing analytics, oftentimes if you're thinking about people in the loop, you don't need to run the query to completion. People are just trying to get an idea of what's in the database and some approximate answers. And so there's a part of the system called BlinkDB that implements that. There's also some sampling stuff that we use for data cleaning. I'm not going to have time to go into this. But, that's another key technique that you want to put in the system is sampling and approximation because you're working with large data sets. And the other thing I just want to mention, in the database community, there is kind of a movement towards specialization of systems. So, Mike Stonebreaker, who recently won the Turing Award, has been for years going around saying, one size doesn't fit all. If you want to do scientific data, you need this system. If you want to do transactional processing, you need this other system. If you want to do analytics, you need this third system. And what we found is that's not necessarily what everybody wants. And this was a survey that we did of Spark users last summer with about 1,400 respondents. And we asked them, which parts of the system that you use. And you can see that, most people use at least two of the systems. They'll use Spark with SQL, or they'll use SQL with streaming, or whatever. And a number of people use three or four of these different interfaces. So, we've found, at least in the world that we live in, big data analytics, There is a real need and a real desire to not have to take lots of different systems and figure out how to put them together, okay? And so that's kind of the main, that's actually the main story I wanted to give of all the trends I was going to talk about. That's the one that I wanted to emphasize the most, was this idea of, you know, building a single unified stack that gives you these different modalities for working with data. So, okay, so like I said, I was going to spend a lot of time on that one. I'm going to go a little quicker. I'm going to need, I know we were running late, so I need somebody, one of the organizers, to tell me when they want me to stop. Okay, great. So I will finish by about 15:15. All right, good. So, so the big trend, if you want to remember one trend, the one I want to push, integrated stacks. But let me talk about a few other things going on. So there's a lot of excitement these days around stream processing, around real-time processing. And for those of you who know me, I mean, this is a topic that I worked on quite a while ago. I started a company and sold a company that was doing this kind of stream processing. My version of stream processing was sort of the third generation of that stuff. I think now this is the fourth generation of that stuff. And what you find is, maybe this time, this stuff is really going to catch on in a big way. And so there's all this stuff going on. If you look out there, there's, you know, Storm, there's Spark streaming, there's Flink streaming. You know, Google's got a bunch of systems that they put out that do streaming. And if you look at, you know, any of the trade press, you know, there's a huge amount of ink spent on real-time processing. And the idea, it makes sense, is, you know, as data is coming in, you want to be able to process it and see what's going on right away. You don't want to do batch storage where you store stuff and then, you know, a day or a week later you actually find out what's in there. And so, you know, this stuff is catching on. And there's was an idea floating around, and it's still actually pretty popular, called the Lambda architecture. And the idea was that, you know, I've got my data coming in, and there are some things that I want to do the traditional way. I want to run as batch processes, you know, typical reporting and kind of historical analysis. But there's a bunch of other things that I want to do in real time. So as the data is coming in, I want to be monitoring it. I want to be running, you know, metrics on it, and then looking for trends and looking for things that are changing. And so the idea of the Lambda architecture was, you know, you would take something like Hadoop or Spark and you'd use that as your batch layer. You'd take something like Storm or Kafka and you'd use that as your speed layer. And then when you answered a question, when somebody asked a question, you would provide an answer that would somehow combine the results from the batch engine and the results from this other streaming engine. Okay, and that's the Lambda architecture, and there's lots of people implementing this. The thing is, there's been, some pushback on this. As I said, I worked in this topic a long, you know, not that long. Well, that was the end of that. But, a bunch of people in the database world had worked on this topic, and we didn't do it this way. We try to unify things. And then, more recently, some people in the big data world have also said, well, geez, you know, maybe that's not the right way to do it. Because the problem is, you know, it's the same problem we had with the stovepipe systems. You have to write everything twice. Once for the batch system, once for the streaming system. If you've got a bug, you got to find it in both places and fix it in both places. If it exists in both places, maybe it only exists on one side or the other. These systems, you know, were not built by the same people to solve the same problem, so there's probably very subtle differences in the semantics. And given that your answers, I don't have the picture up there anymore. Given that your answers are combining results from the batch processor and the stream processor, you know, when you combine them, if they've got different underlying semantics, how do you do that correctly, if you care about correctness? How do you just put these things together? So there's a lot of problems, you know, with this Lambda architecture. And so, a bunch of people, Spark being one of them, said, okay, you know, again, let's try to build a unified system. So Spark Streaming is our version of a unified system. It takes data from streaming sources, and it then, you know, processes them using Spark. That's the basic idea. And what it does is it uses this thing called a micro-batch approach. So what it'll do is it'll take your incoming data and it'll split it into a sequence of RDDs based on time. So if you want to have, you know, an RDD, you know, say once a second you create an RDD of all the data that came in that second, and then you can run Spark on each of those RDDs one after the other. And then what Spark Streaming does is it has an additional layer on top of it for doing windowing. So your underlying RDDs are sort of your finest granularity of time you can work on. But you can combine those different RDDs to get bigger windows. Okay, and what this ends up looking like, and I'm sorry, this is a bit of an eye chart, so let me just build it out, is, you know, here's a program that reads a file and then counts words in it, right? And here's the main part of that that does the word counting. Here's a program that has a stream, and then as the stream's coming in, every 10 seconds counts the words that showed up in the last 10 seconds. And the important thing here is that you'll notice the code is identical between the batch and the stream. Okay, and so all you're really changing is here you're reading a file, here you're setting up this stream context that's going to give you a new result every 10 seconds. Okay? But again, this is the idea, is you write the program once instead of multiple times. There's a bunch of people that worry about whether this mini batch process is the right way to do it. I honestly was one of them, and I sort of still am. But the thing is that for a lot of these real-time applications, the amount of real time that you need is really, you know, the latency requirements are not that severe. So, you know, there's a lot of quote-unquote real-time applications where, you know, getting an answer every 100 milliseconds or every second or every 5 seconds is exactly fine, and you don't actually want it faster than that. If you need microsecond response time, this isn't going to do it for you. But the percentage of applications for doing data analytics that need microsecond response time are not that high. Okay, so this is catching on, it's being used by a lot of people, and one thing just to keep an eye on is we're adding a bunch of time series functionality to the system as well. So not just sort of traditional streaming processing, but also things that you do in time series where you worry about, you know, correcting for long-term effects and cyclical effects and so on. All right, so all that stuff's getting into the system. Another quick trend I wanted to mention, so streaming is one, this idea of machine learning pipelines. And so, you know, data analytics is complex. You don't just typically take one operator and run it on your data set and you're done. Typically what you do is there's this whole set of processes that you run. You get the data, you clean the data, you run a series of, you know, you featureize it, you build models on those features, you test those models, you go back and test them again and so on. And so there's been a lot of interest lately in building out kind of these bigger systems for doing end-to-end machine learning, let's call it. And Spark has a couple. Google released something called TensorFlow, which is getting a lot of excitement, a lot of interest, especially in the deep learning community. And Keystone ML is the one I'm going to tell you about, which is again in Spark. So the idea is, you know, you have a bunch of operators, and what you want to do is you want to allow a programmer, or developer, or an analyst to write their program using some high-level language, right, where they say, here's what I want to learn, or here's what I want to predict. Or maybe one level below that, where you give them a language, domain-specific language that has you know, logical operators, and you let them express it that way. But then what you want to do is, just as in a database system where, you know, you might write a SQL query, but that's the SQL query isn't exactly what gets executed by the system. It's the system takes that, it says, okay, now I understand what answer you're looking for, let me figure out the right way to get you that answer. That's what we want to do here. So we want to say, okay, this is a logical expression of what you're trying to learn. Let us figure out how we can get you that same answer faster and with good accuracy. So one of the things that comes up in doing machine learning types of optimizations instead of traditional database optimizations. In database optimizations, there's a right answer, and the idea is to get it faster. Machine learning, there's this completely other dimension, which is you get to play around with the accuracy as well. So you have this new trade-off of speed and accuracy. So what we do, we have a system called Keystone ML. It's a little bit of a joke. It's pipelines for machine learning. And what it'll do is really a couple things. One is it'll take a logical operator, so you can say, hey, I know here I want a linear solver. And it'll say, okay, well, you know, we've got three or four or a dozen linear solvers, and the one that's going to give you the best performance depends on, you know, the size and the shape of your data. So, you know, based on what I understand about your data sets, I'm going to pick, you know, one of my physical implementations of that logical operator. Okay, so that's something you typically do in a query optimizer. And then the other thing is then to look at the entire pipeline and say, okay, what's the right order of operations? Do I have any ability to sort of you know, switch things around so that I can get rid of, you know, you always want to filter out as much data as possible early in the processing so that you don't have to work with it, you know, in subsequent steps. So I want to do those sorts of selection pushing and those types of optimizations. And I also want to be smart about caching data. So one of the things that Keystone ML has in it is the ability to then look at the entire sequence of operations and figure out which parts of those pipelines should be materialized and kept in memory or on disk for subsequent use. Okay, so, yep, let me just finish up. So you know, just where Keystone ML is we just recently released a new version. It's got a bunch of new operators in there for doing, you know, images, speech, text, and so on. It's got some optimizations, the ones I told you about for choosing physical operators and materializations, and we're adding into it you know, a bunch of new operators. So Keystone ML is available if you want to download it and try it out. All right, so that's the third trend I wanted to mention was pipelines. I think in the interest of time, I am going to I knew I wasn't going to get through it. So let me just say quickly, the fourth trend I wanted to talk about quickly was model serving. So the idea is that there's lots of work going on. If you look in the machine learning literature, there's a lot of work on saying, hey, I want to build a model of my data. I've got a lot of data. How do I do that efficiently? Once you've built that model, that you then want to use it in an application. You want to use that model to serve predictions to people or to services. And so the question is, how do you do that serving? What happens now is you run your model in your batch system. You take that model, you store it in a separate serving system, oftentimes a relational database, and then you serve it out of that. And as you can tell, this theme that we have is we don't want to do it that way. We want to see if we can build an integrated system. And so what we've realized is that there's a bunch of machine learning models that can be split pretty easily into a batch component that sort of looks at a large population and changes relatively slowly. And then a series of individual models that you can keep for, say, each user or each piece of equipment that you're measuring. And that one can change quickly. And we're building a system called Velox that then, when you need to make a prediction, you know, in real time, takes the personalized model, combines that with the batch model, and gives you an answer. And when you do that, it has a very interesting systems result, which is then you can think about if you can, that line between the batch, the line between the batch and the online is an API. You can start thinking about putting any other batch systems you want behind that API. So this becomes a way of thinking about integrating multiple machine learning systems into a service that serves predictions. All right, so with that, I am gonna just quickly wrap up. So here are the things I just wanted to mention about trends. You know, the one I spent most of the time on was integrated systems and tried to make the argument that it is possible, and we've got an existence proof, to build a system that lets you work with data in lots of different ways and can do so efficiently across those different ways of working with the data. And there's a lot of benefits for doing that. And then talked a little bit about real time, pipelines of machine learning, a little bit of serving and of models. And then I didn't have time to go into it. I'm happy to talk to you about what's going on here about this. But you know, the idea of now that there is a well-known infrastructure for dealing with big data, it's moving into other areas. So there's a lot of work now on using big data in high-performance computing environments and for scientific applications. There's a lot of work on integrating big data technology into Internet of Things types of applications. And I really didn't have too much to say about that other than that it's going on and we're doing some work there. So I'm happy to talk to people about that. So I think with that, I'm gonna just wrap up here. The one thing I want to leave you with is, especially for the students in the audience, but also for the faculty and also for the industry people, you know, the work that I was talking about was all done by students in an academic lab. We heavily leveraged the open source community, and we heavily leveraged our interactions with industry. And the reason that our students were able to build software that ends up being, you know, of use and of interest to people in the industry is because all along the way, you know, we had people from industry working with us and giving us advice and helping to give us feedback on the kinds of things we're doing. And so, you know, getting a community like this together of people from academia and industry, I think is incredibly powerful. You know, it's something we've successfully done, you know, at my previous place of employment, and you know, Andrew and many other people here are working on making it happen in the Midwest, and I'm happy to participate. I'm looking forward to working with all of you. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Mike. That was terrific. Thank you. So why don't we, Fred, do you want to come on up? Mike, maybe we have time for a quick question while Fred's hooking up?
Sure.
Anyone got a quick question for Mike? Yeah, go ahead. Just shout it out.
Yeah, great. So so the question is, you know, given a big data problem, especially high performance computing problem, you know, how do you decide between using big data software or, you know, HPC software? I think a lot of that, honestly, is going to be driven by where you're going to be able to leverage the most existing software. So. You know, our work on fusing HPC and say Spark has been largely looking at how do you build applications that use Spark as kind of the substrate for doing job control and parallelization, but are able to call out to existing high performance computing routines to leverage what's already been built. So. I know that's not a really deep answer, but that's what we've been doing so far, and I should probably yield the microphone. So.
All right, let's